Yet he fights on grimly, will not yield. It is for your sake, I think. He needs your forgiveness. The war has made the road from the Aire to River Run dangerous to travel, I know, but surely a strong force of knights could see you safely through the Mountains of the Moon, 100 men or 1,000. And if you cannot come, will you not write him, at least, a few words of love, so he might die in peace? Write what you will, and I shall read it to him, and ease his way. Even as she set the quill aside and asked for sealing wax, Catelyn sensed that the letter was like to be too little and too late. Maester Wyman did not believe Lord Huster would linger long enough for a raven to reach the Aire and return, though he has said much the same before. Tully men did not surrender easily, no matter the odds. After she entrusted the parchment to the maester's care, Catelyn went to the sept and lit a candle to the father above for her own father's sake, a second to the crone who had let the first raven into the world when she appeared through the door of death, and a third to the mother, for Lysa and all the children they had both lost. Later that day, as she sat at Lord Huster's bedside with a book, reading the same passage over and over, she heard the sound of loud voices and a trumpet's blare. "Sir Robin," she thought at once, flinching. She went to the balcony. There was nothing to be seen out on the rivers, but she could hear the voices more clearly from outside, the sound of many horses, the clink of armour, and here and there a cheer. Catelyn made her way up the winding stairs to the roof of the keep. "Sir Desmond did not forbid me the roof," she told herself as she climbed. The sounds were coming from the far side of the castle, by the main gate. A knot of men stood before the portcullis as it rose in jerks and starts, and in the field beyond, outside the castle, were several hundred riders. When the wind blew, it lifted their banners, and she trembled in relief at the sight of the leaping trout of River Run. Edmure. It was 2 hours before he saw fit to come to her. By then the castle rang to the sound of noisy reunions, as men embraced the women and children they had left behind. 3 ravens had risen from the rookery, black wings beating at the air as they took flight. Catelyn watched them from her father's balcony. She had washed her hair, changed her clothes, and prepared herself for her brother's reproaches, but even so, the waiting was hard. When at last she heard sounds outside her door, she sat and folded her hands in her lap. Dried red mud spattered Edmure's boots, greaves, and surcoat. To look at him, you would never know he had won his battle. He was thin and drawn, with pale cheeks, unkempt beard, and 2 bright eyes. "Edmure," Catelyn said, worried, "you look unwell. Has something happened? Have the Lannisters crossed the river?" "I threw them back. Lord Tywin, Gregor Clegane, Adam Marbrand, I turned them away. Stannis, though." He grimaced. "Stannis? What of Stannis?" "He lost the battle at King's Landing," Edmure said unhappily. "His fleet was burned, his army routed." A Lannister victory was ill tidings, but Catelyn could not share her brother's obvious dismay. She still had nightmares about the shadow she had seen slide across Renly's tent, and the way the blood had come flowing out through the steel of his gorget. "Stannis was no more a friend than Lord Tywin." "You do not understand. Highgarden has declared for Joffrey, Dorne as well, all the south." His mouth tightened. "And you see fit to loose the Kingslayer? You had no right."
"I had a mother's right." Her voice was calm, though the news about Highgarden was a savage blow to Rob's hopes. She could not think about that now, though.
"No right," Edmure repeated. "He was Rob's captive, your king's captive, and Rob charged me to keep him safe."
"Brian will keep him safe." She swore it on her sword.
"Ach, that woman!"
"She will deliver Jaime to King's Landing and bring Arya and Sansa back to us safely."
"Cersei will never give them up."
"Not Cersei, Tyrion,"
He swore it in open court, and the Kingslayer swore it as well. Jamie's word is worthless. As for the imp, it said he took an axe in the head during the battle. He'll be dead before your Brienne reaches King's Landing, if she ever does.
Dead? Could the gods truly be so merciless?
She had made Jamie swear 100 oaths, but it was his brother's promise she had pinned her hopes on. Edmure was blind to her distress. Jamie was my charge, and I mean to have him back. I've sent ravens.
Ravens? To whom? How many?
3, he answered. So the message will be certain to reach Lord Bolton. By river or road, the way from River Run to King's Landing must needs take them close by Harrenhal.
Harrenhal? The very word seemed to darken the room. Horror thickened her voice as she said, Edmure, do you know what you have done?
Have no fear. I left your part out. I wrote that Jamie had escaped, and offered 1,000 dragons for his recapture.
Worse and worse, Catelyn thought, in despair. My brother is a fool. Unbidden, unwanted, tears filled her eyes. If this was an escape, she said softly, and not an exchange of hostages, why should the Lannisters give my daughters to Brienne?
It will never come to that. The Kingslayer will be returned to us. I have made certain of it.
All you have made certain is that I shall never see my daughters again. Brienne might have gotten him to King's Landing safely, so long as no one was hunting for them. But now... Catelyn could not go on.
Leave me, Edmure.
She had no right to command him, here in the castle that would soon be his, yet her tone would brook no argument.
Leave me to father and my grief. I have no more to say to you. Go, go!
All she wanted was to lie down, to close her eyes and sleep, and pray no dreams would come.
Daenerys. She could hear the dead man coming up the steps. The slow, measured sound of footsteps went before him, echoing amongst the purple pillars of her hall. Daenerys Targaryen awaited him upon the ebon bench that she had made her throne. Her eyes were soft with sleep, her silver-gold hair all tousled.
"Your Grace," said Sir Barristan Selmy, the Lord Commander of a Queen's Guard, "there is no need for you to see this. He died for me."
Danny clutched a lion-pelt to her chest. Underneath, a sheer white linen tunic covered her to mid-thigh. She had been dreaming of a house with a red door when Missandei woke her. There had been no time to dress.
"Khaleesi," whispered Eri, "you must not touch the dead man. It is bad luck to touch the dead."
"Unless you kill them yourself." Jiqui was bigger bone than Eri, with wide hips and heavy breasts.
"That is known."
"It is known," Eri agreed. Dothraki were wise where horses were concerned, but could be utter fools about much else.
"They are only girls, besides."
Her handmaids were of an age with her, women grown to look at them, with their black hair, copper-skinned and almond-shaped eyes, but girls all the same. They had been given to her when she wed Khal Drogo. It was Drogo who had given her the pelt she wore, the head and hide of Rakha, the white lion of the Dothraki Sea. It was too big for her and had a musty smell, but it made her feel as if her sun and stars were still near her. Grey Worm appeared atop the steps first, a torch in hand. His bronze cap was crested with 3 spikes. Behind him followed 4 of his unsullied, bearing the dead man on their shoulders. Their caps had only 1 spike each, and their faces showed so little they might have been cast in bronze as well. They laid the corpse down at her feet. Sir Barristan pulled back the blood-stained shroud. Grey Worm lowered the torch so she might see. The dead man's face was smooth and hairless, though his cheeks had been slashed open ear to ear. He had been a tall man, blue-eyed and fair of face,
some child of Lice or old Valentus, snatched off a ship by corsairs and sold into bondage in Red Astapor.
Though his eyes were open, it was his wounds that wept. There were more wounds than she could count.
"Your Grace," Sir Barristan said, "there was a harpy drawn on the bricks in the alley where he was found. Drawn in blood." Daenerys knew the way of it by now. The sons of the harpy did their butchery by night. Over each kill they left their mark.
Grey Worm, why was this man alone? Had he no partner?
By her command, when the Unsullied walked the streets of Meereen by night, they always walked in pairs.
"My queen," replied the captain, "your servant, Stalworth Shield, had no duty last night. He had gone to a certain place to drink and have companionship."
"A certain place? What do you mean?"
"A house of pleasure, your grace."
"A brothel. Half of her freedmen were from Yunkai, where the wise masters had been famed for training bed slaves."
"The way of the seven sighs."
"Brothels had sprouted up like mushrooms all over Meereen. It's all they know. They need to survive."
Food was more costly every day, whilst the price of flesh grew cheaper. In the poorer districts between the step pyramids of Meereen's slaver nobility, there were brothels catering to every conceivable erotic taste she knew.
"Even so, what could a eunuch hope to find in a brothel?"
"Even those who lack a man's parts may still have a man's heart, your grace," said Grey Worm. "This one has been told that your servant Stalwart Shield sometimes gave coin to the women of the brothels to lie with him and hold him."
"The blood of the dragon does not weep."
"Stalwart Shield," she said dry-eyed.
"That was his name?"
"If it please your grace."
"It is a fine name."
The good masters of Astapor had not allowed their slave soldiers even names. Some of her Unsullied reclaimed their birth names after she had freed them. Others chose new names for themselves.
"Is it known how many attackers fell upon Stalwart Shield?"
"This one does not know. Many."
Six or more," said Sir Barristan. "From the look of his wounds, they swarmed him from all sides. He was found with an empty scabbard. It may be that he wounded some of his attackers."
Dennis said a silent prayer that somewhere one of the harpy's sons was dying even now, clutching at his belly and writhing in pain.
"Why did they cut open his cheeks like that?"
"Gracious queen," said Grey Worm, "his killers had forced the genitals of a goat down the throat of your servant, Stalwart Shield. This one removed them before bringing him here."
"They could not feed him his own genitals. The Astapori left him neither root nor stem." "The sons grow bolder,"
Danny observed. "Until now they had limited their attacks to unarmed freedmen, cutting them down in the streets or breaking into their homes under the cover of darkness to murder them in their beds."
"This is the first of my soldiers they have slain."
"The first," Sir Barristan warned, "but not the last."
"I am still at war," Danny realized. "Only now I am fighting shadows."
She had hoped for a respite from the killing, for some time to build and heal. Shrugging off the lion pelt, she knelt beside the corpse and closed the dead man's eyes, ignoring Jiqui's gasp.
"Stalwart Shield shall not be forgotten. Have him washed and dressed for battle, and bury him with cap and shield and spear."
"It shall be as your grace commands," said Grey Worm.
"Send men to the Temple of the Graces and ask if any man has come to the Blue Graces with a sword wound, and spread the word that we will pay good gold for the short sword of Stalwart Shield. Inquire of the butchers and the herdsmen, and learn who has been gelding goats of late.
Perhaps some goat-herd would confess.
Henceforth, no man of mine walks alone after dark."
"These one shall obey."
Daenerys pushed her hair back.
Find these cowards for me. Find them, so that I might teach the Harpy's sons what it means to wake the dragon.
Grey Worm saluted her. His unsullied closed the shroud once more, lifted the dead man onto their shoulders, and bore him from the hall. Sir Barristan Selmyr remained behind. His hair was white, and there were crow's feet at the corners of his pale blue eyes. Yet his back was still unbent, and the years had not rubbed him of his skill at arms.
"Your Grace," he said, "I fear your eunuchs are ill-suited for the tasks you set them."
Danae settled on her bench and wrapped her pelt about her shoulders once again.
"The Unsullied are my finest warriors."
"Soldiers, not warriors, if it please your Grace. They were made for the battlefield, to stand shoulder to shoulder behind their shields with their spears thrust out before them. Their training teaches them to obey fearlessly, perfectly, without thought or hesitation, not to unravel secrets or ask questions."
"Would knights serve me any better?"
Selmyr was training knights for her, teaching the sons of slaves to fight with lance and longsword in the Westerosi fashion. But what good would lances do against cowards who kill from the shadows?
"Not in this," the old man admitted, "and your Grace has no knights, save me. It will be years before the boys are ready." "Then who, if not Unsullied? Dothraki would be even worse."
"Dothraki fought from horseback. Mounted men were of more use in open fields and hills than in the narrow streets and alleys of the city. Beyond Meereen's walls of many-coloured brick, Danny's rule was tenuous at best. Thousands of slaves still toiled on vast estates in the hills, growing wheat and olives, herding sheep and goats, and mining salt and copper. Meereen's storehouses held ample supplies of grain, oil, olives, dried fruit, and salted meat. But the stores were dwindling, so Danny had dispatched her tiny Khalasar to subdue the hinterlands under the command of her three blood riders, whilst Bran Ben Plum took his second son south to guard against Yunkish incursions. The most crucial task of all she had entrusted to Dario Naharis, glib-tongued Dario with his gold tooth and trident beard, smiling his wicked smile through purple whiskers. Beyond the eastern hills was a range of rounded sandstone mountains, the Kaizai Pass, and Lazar. If Dario could convince the Lazarine to reopen the overland trade routes, grains could be brought down the river or over the hills at need. But the Lamb Men had no reason to love Meereen.
"When the Storm Crows return from Lazar, perhaps I can use them in the streets," she told Ser Barristan. "But until then, I have only the Unsullied."
Danny rose.
"You must excuse me, sir. The petitioners will soon be at my gates. I must don my floppy ears and become their queen again. Summon Resnack and the Sheath Pit. I'll see them when I'm dressed."
"As your Grace commands,"
Selmy bowed.
The great pyramid shouldered 800 feet into the sky, from its huge square base to the lofty apex where the queen kept her private chambers, surrounded by greenery and fragrant pools. As a cool blue dawn broke over the city, Danny walked out onto the terrace. To the west, sunlight blazed off the golden domes of the Temple of the Graces and etched deep shadows behind the step pyramids of the mighty.
"In some of those pyramids, the sons of the Harpy are plotting new murders even now, and I am powerless to stop them."
Viserion sensed her disquiet. The white dragon lay coiled around a pear tree, his head resting on his tail. When Danny passed, his eyes came open, two pools of molten gold. His horns were gold as well, and the scales that ran down his back from head to tail.
"You're lazy,"
she told him, scratching under his jaw. His scales were hot to the touch, like armor left too long in the sun.
"Dragons are fire made flesh."
She had read that in one of the books that Jorah had given her as a wedding gift.
"You should be hunting," with your brothers. Have you and Drogon been fighting again?
Her dragons were growing wild of late. Rhaegal had snapped at Iri, and Viserion had set Resnik's Tokar ablaze the last time the Seneschal had called.
I have left them too much to themselves, but where am I to find the time for them?
Viserion's tail lashed sideways, thumping the trunk of the tree so hard that a pear came tumbling down to land at Danny's feet. His wings unfolded, and he half flew, half hopped onto the parapet.
He grows, she thought,
as he launched himself into the sky.
They are all three growing. Soon they will be large enough to bear my weight.
Then she would fly as Aegon the Conqueror had flown, up and up until Meereen was so small that she could blot it out with her thumb. She watched Viserion climb in widening circles until he was lost to sight beyond muddy waters of the Skahazadan. Only then did Danny go back inside the pyramid, where Iri and Jiqui were waiting to brush the tangles from her hair and garb her as befit the Queen of Meereen in a Gascari toka. The garment was a clumsy thing, a long, loose, shapeless sheet that had to be wound around her hips and under an arm and over a shoulder, its dangling fringes carefully layered and displayed. Wound too loose, it was like to fall off. Wound too tight, it would tangle, trip, and bind. Even wound properly, the tokar required its wearer to hold it in place with a left hand. Walking in a tokar demanded small, mincing steps and exquisite balance, lest one tread upon those heavy trailing fringes. It was not a garment meant for any man who had to work. The tokar was a master's garment, a sign of wealth and power. Danny had wanted to ban the tokar when she took Meereen, but her advisers had convinced her otherwise.
The mother of dragons must don the tokar, or be forever hated,
warned the Green Grace, Galatza Galari.
In the wools of Westeros, or a gown of Meerish lace, your radiance shall forever remain a stranger amongst us, a grotesque outlander, a barbarian conqueror. Meereen's queen must be a lady of old Gis.
Bran Ben Plum, the captain of the Second Sons, had put it more succinctly.
Man wants to be the king of the rabbits. He'd best wear a pair of floppy ears.
The floppy ears she chose today were made of sheer white linen, with a fringe of golden tassels. With Jiki's help, she wound the tokar about herself correctly on her third attempt. Iri fetched her crown, wrought in the shape of a three-headed dragon of her house. Its coils were gold, its wings silver, its three heads ivory, onyx, and jade. Danny's neck and shoulders would be stiff and sore from the weight of it before the day was done.
A crown should not sit easy on the head.
One of her royal forebears had said that once.
Some Aegon, but which one?
Five Aegons had ruled the seven kingdoms of Westeros. There would have been a sixth, but the usurper's dogs had murdered her brother's son when he was still a babe at the breast.
If he had lived, I might have married him. Aegon would have been closer to my age than Viserys.
Danny had only been conceived when Aegon and his sister were murdered. Their father, her brother Rhaegar, perished even earlier, slain by the usurper on the Trident. Her brother Viserys had died screaming in Vaes Dothrak, with a crown of molten gold upon his head.
They would kill me too, if I allow it. The knives that slew my stalwart shield were meant for me.
She had not forgotten the slave children the great masters had nailed up along the road from Yunkai. They had numbered 163, a child every mile, nailed to mileposts, with one arm outstretched to point her way. After Meereen had fallen, Danny had nailed up a like number of great masters. Swarms of flies had attended their slow dying, and the stench had lingered long in the plaza. Yet some day she feared that she had not gone far enough. These Meereenese were a sly and stubborn people who resisted her at every turn. They had freed their slaves, yes, only to hire them back as servants at wages so meagre that most could scarce afford to eat. Those too old or young to be of use had been cast into the streets, along with the infirm and the crippled. And still the great masters gathered atop their lofty pyramids to complain of how the Dragon Queen had filled their noble city with hordes of unwashed beggars, thieves, and whores. To rule Meereen, I must win the Meereenese, however much I may despise them. I am ready, she told Iri. Reznak and Skahaz waited atop the marble steps. Great Queen, declared Reznak Mo Reznak, you are so radiant today, I fear to look on you. The seneschal wore a tokar of maroon silk with a golden fringe. A small, damp man, he smelled as if he had bathed in perfume and spoke a bastard form of high Valyrian, much corrupted and flavoured with a thick Giscari growl. You are kind to say so, Danny answered in the same tongue. My queen, growled Skahaz Mokandak of the shaven head. Giscari hair was dense and wiry. It had long been the fashion for the men of the slaver cities to tease it into horns and spikes and wings. By shaving, Skahaz had put old Meereen behind him to accept the new, and his kin had done the same after his example. Others followed, though whether from fear, fashion, or ambition, Danny could not say. Shave-pates, they were called. Skahaz was the shave-pate, and the vilest of traitors to the sons of the Harpy and their ilk. We were told about the eunuch. His name was Stalwart Shield. More will die unless the murderers are punished. Even with his shaven scalp, Skahaz had an odious face, a beetled brow, small eyes with heavy bags beneath them, a big nose dark with blackheads, oily skin that looked more yellow than the usual amber of Giscari. It was a blunt, brutal, angry face. She could only pray it was an honest one as well.
"Well, how can I punish them when I do not know who they are?" Danny demanded of him. "Tell me that, bold Skahaz."
"You have no lack of enemies, your grace. You can see their pyramids from your terrace. Zak, Haskar, Gazin, Merrick, Lorak, all the old slaving families. Pal, most of all. A house of women now. Bitter old women with a taste for blood. Women do not forget. Women do not forgive."
No, Danny thought, and the usurper's dogs will learn that when I return to Westeros.
It was true that there was blood between her and the House of Pal. Osnak Zopal had been cut down by strong Belwas in single combat. His father, commander of Meereen's city watch, had died defending the gates when Jossa's cock smashed them into splinters. Three uncles had been among the 163 on the plaza.
How much gold have we offered for information concerning the sons of the Harpy? Danny asked.
100 honors, if it please your radiance.
1,000 honors would please us more. Make it so.
Your grace has not asked for my counsel, said Skahar Shavepate. But I say that blood must pay for blood. Take one man from each of the families I've named and kill him. The next time one of yours is slain, take two from each great house and kill them both. There will not be a third murder.
Reznak squealed in distress.
No, gentle queen, such savagery would bring down the ire of the gods. We will find the murderers, I promise you. And when we do, they will prove to be base-born filth. You shall see.
The seneschal was as bold as Skahaz, though in his case the guards were responsible.
Should any here be so insolent as to appear, my barber stands with razor ready,
he had assured her when she raised him up. There were times when Danny wondered if that razor might not be better saved for Resnick's throat. He was a useful man, but she liked him little and trusted him less. Then dying of Karth had told her she would be thrice betrayed. Miri Mazdur had been the first, Ser Jorah the second. Would Resnick be the third, the shave-pate, Dario? Or will it be someone I would never suspect? Sir Barristan, or Grey Worm, or Masandi?
Scarhas, she told the shave-pate, I thank you for your counsel. Resnick, see what 1,000 honours may accomplish. Clutching her toka, Daenerys swept past them down the broad marble stair. She took one step at a time, lest she trip over her fringe and go tumbling head first into court. Missandei announced her. The little scribe had a sweet, strong voice. All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons.
The hall had filled. Unsullied stood with their backs to the pillars, holding shields and spears, the spikes on their caps jutting upward like a row of knives. The Myrinese had gathered beneath the eastern windows. Her freedmen stood well apart from their former masters.
Until they stand together, Meereen will know no peace. Arise, Danny settled into her bench. The hall rose. That, at least, they do as one.
Resnack Mo Resnack had a list. Custom demanded that the queen begin with the Astapori envoy, a former slave who called himself Lord Gale, though no one seemed to know what he was lord of. Lord Gale had a mouth of brown and rotten teeth, and the pointed yellow face of a weasel. He also had a gift. Cleon the Great sends these slippers as a token of his love for Daenerys Stormborn, the Mother of Dragons. Iri slid the slippers under Danny's feet. They were gilded leather, decorated with green freshwater pearls.
Does the Butcher King believe a pair of pretty slippers will win my hand? King Cleon is most generous. You may thank him for his lovely gift. Lovely, but made for a child.
Danny had small feet, yet the pointed slippers mashed her toes together. Great Cleon would be pleased to know they pleased you, said Lord Gale. His magnificence bids me say that he stands ready to defend the Mother of Dragons from all her foes.
If he propose again that I wed King Cleon, I'll throw a slipper at his head, Danny thought.
But for once the Astapori envoy made no mention of a royal marriage. Instead he said, The time has come for Astapor and Meereen to end the savage reign of the wise masters of Yunkai, who are sworn foes to all those who live in freedom. Great Cleon bids me tell you that he and his new Unsullied will soon march.
His new Unsullied are an obscene jape. King Cleon would be wise to tend his own gardens and let the Yunkai tend theirs.
It was not that Danny harbored any love for Yunkai. She was coming to regret leaving the Yellow City untaken after defeating its army in the field. The wise masters had returned to slaving as soon as she moved on, and were busy raising levies, hiring sellswords, and making alliances against her. Cleon, the self-styled great, was no better, however. The Butcher King had restored slavery to Astapor, the only change being that the former slaves were now the masters, and the former masters were now the slaves.
I am only a young girl and know little of the ways of war, she told Lord Gale, but we have heard that Astapor is starving. Let King Cleon feed his people before he leads them out to battle.
She made a gesture of dismissal. Gale withdrew. Magnificence, prompted Resnack Mo Resnack. Will you hear the noble Hisdar Zo Lorek? Again? Danny nodded, and Hisdar strode forth, a tall man, very slender, with flawless amber skin. He bowed on the same spot where Stalwart's shield had lain in death not long before.
I need this man, Danny reminded herself.
Hisdar was a wealthy merchant, with many friends in Meereen, and more across the seas. He had visited Volantis, Lys, and Karth, had kin in Tolos and Illyria, and was even said to wield some influence in New Gis, where the Yunkai were trying to stir up enmity against Dany and her rule. And he was rich, famously and fabulously rich.
"And like to grow richer, if I grant his petition."
When Dany had closed the city's fighting pits, the value of pit shares had plummeted. Hisdar Zolorek had grabbed them up with both hands and now owned most of the fighting pits in Meereen. The nobleman had wings of wiry red-black hair sprouting from his temples. They made him look as if his head were about to take flight. His long face was made even longer by a beard bound with rings of gold. His purple tokar was fringed with amethysts and pearls.
"Your radiance will know the reason I am here. Why, it must be because you have no other purpose but to plague me. How many times have I refused you?" "Five times, your magnificence." "Six now. I will not have the fighting pits reopened. If your majesty will hear my arguments..." "I have. Five times. Have you brought new arguments?" "Old arguments," Hisdar admitted. "New words, lovely words, and courteous, more apt to move a queen." "It is your cause I find wanting, not your courtesies. I've heard your arguments so often, I could plead your case myself. Shall I?"
Dany leaned forward.
"The fighting pits have been a part of Meereen since the city was founded. The combats are profoundly religious in nature, a blood sacrifice to the gods of Gis. The mortal art of Gis is not mere butchery, but a display of courage, skill, and strength most pleasing to your gods. Victorious fighters are pampered and acclaimed, and the slain are honored and remembered. By reopening the pits, I would show the people of Meereen that I respect their ways and customs. The pits are far famed across the world. They draw trade to Meereen and fill the city's coffers with coin from the ends of the earth. All men share a taste for blood, a taste the pits help slake. In that way they make Meereen more tranquil. For criminals condemned to die upon the sands, the pits represent a judgment by battle, a last chance for a man to prove his innocence."
She leaned back again, with a toss of her head.
"There. How have I done?"
"Your radiance has stated the case much better than I could have hoped to do myself. I see that you are eloquent as well as beautiful. I am quite persuaded."
She had to laugh.
"But I am not."
"Your magnificence," whispered Resnek Mo Resnek in her ear. "It is customary for the city to claim one-tenth of all the profits from the fighting pits, after expenses, as a tax. That coin might be put to many noble uses."
"It might, though if we were to reopen the pits, we should take our tenth before expenses. I am only a young girl and know little of such matters, but I dwelt with Zarozo and Daxos long enough to learn that much. Hisdar, if you could marshal armies as you marshal arguments, you could conquer the world. But my answer is still no, for the sixth time."
"The queen has spoken."
He bowed again, as deeply as before. His pearls and amethysts clattered softly against the marble floor. A very limber man was Hisdar Zolorek.
"Yeah, he might be handsome, but for that silly hair."
Resnek and the Green Grace had been urging Dany to take a Meereenese noble for her husband, to reconcile the city to her rule. Hisdar Zolorek might be worth a careful look. Sooner him than Scar has. The shave-pate had offered to set aside his wife for her, but the notion made her shudder. Hisdar, at least, knew how to smile.
"Magnificence," said Resnek, consulting his list. "The noble Grazdan Zogalari would address you. Will you hear him?"
"It would be my pleasure," said Dany,
admiring the glimmer of the gold and the sheen of the green pearls on Cleon's slippers, while doing her best to ignore the pinching in her toes. Grasdan, she had been forewarned, was a cousin of the Green Grace, whose support she had found invaluable. The priestess was a voice for peace, acceptance, and obedience to lawful authority.
"I can give her cousin a respectful hearing, whatever he desires."
What he desired turned out to be gold. Danny had refused to compensate any of the great masters for the value of their slaves, but the Myroneers kept devising other ways to squeeze coin from her. The noble Grasdan had once owned a slave woman who was a very fine weaver, it seemed. The fruits of her loom were greatly valued, not only in Myrin, but in New Gis and Astapor and Karth. When this woman had grown old, Grasdan had purchased half a dozen young girls and commanded the crone to instruct them in the secrets of her craft. The old woman was dead now. The young ones, freed, had opened a shop by the harbour wall to sell their weavings. Grasdan Zogalari asked that he be granted a portion of their earnings. "They owe their skill to me," he insisted. "I pluck them from the auction block and gave them to the loom." Danny listened quietly, her face still. When he was done, she said,
"What was the name of the old weaver?"
The slave? Grasdan shifted his weight, frowning. She was Elsa, it might have been, or Ella. It was 6 years ago she died. I have owned so many slaves, Your Grace.
Let us say Elsa. Here is our ruling. From the girl you shall have nothing. It was Elsa who taught them weaving, not you. From you the girl shall have a new loom the finest coin can buy. That is for forgetting the name of the old woman.
Resnick would have summoned another tokar next, but Danny insisted that he call upon a freedman. Thereafter she alternated between the former masters and the former slaves. Many and more of the matters brought before her involved redress. Myrian had been sacked savagely after its fall. The stepped pyramids of the mighty had been spared the worst of the ravages. But the humbler parts of the city had been given over to an orgy of looting and killing, as the city slaves rose up and the starving hordes who had followed her from Yunkai and Astapor poured through the broken gates. Her unsullied had finally restored order, but the sack left a plague of problems in its wake. And so they came to see the queen. A rich woman came, whose husband and sons had died defending the city walls. During the sack she had fled to her brother in fear. When she returned, she found her house had been turned into a brothel. The whores had bedecked themselves in her jewels and clothes. She wanted her house back and her jewels.
"They can keep the clothes," she allowed.
Danny granted her the jewels, but ruled the house was lost when she abandoned it. A former slave came to accuse a certain noble of the Zak. The man had recently taken to wife a freedwoman who had been the noble's bedwarmer before the city fell. The noble had taken her maidenhood, used her for his pleasure, and gotten her with child. Her new husband wanted the noble gelded for the crime of rape, and he wanted a purse of gold as well, to pay him for raising the noble's bastard as his own. Danny granted him the gold, but not the gelding.
"When he lay with her, your wife was his property, to do with as he would. By law, there was no rape."
Her decision did not please him, she could see, but if she gelded every man who ever forced a bedslave, she would soon rule a city of eunuchs. A boy came, younger than Danny, slight and scarred, dressed up in a frayed grey tokar trailing silver fringe. His voice broke when he told how two of his father's household slaves had risen up the night the gate broke. One had slain his father, the other his elder brother. Both had raped his mother before killing her as well. The boy had escaped with no more than the scar upon his face, but one of the murderers was still living in his father's house, and the other had joined the Queen soldiers as one of the mother's men. He wanted them both hanged.
I am queen over a city built on dust and death.
Danny had no choice but to deny him. She had declared a blanket pardon for all crimes committed during the sack. Nor would she punish slaves for rising up against their masters. When she told him, the boy rushed at her, but his feet tangled in his tow car and he went sprawling headlong on the purple marble. Strong Belwas was on him at once. The huge brown eunuch yanked him up one-handed and shook him like a mastiff with a rat.
"Enough, Belwas," Danny called. "Release him."
To the boy she said, "Treasure that toka, for it saved your life.
You are only a boy, so we will forget what happened here. You should do the same."
But as he left, the boy looked back over his shoulder, and when she saw his eyes, Danny thought,
"The harpy has another son."
By midday, Daenerys was feeling the weight of the crown upon her head and the hardness of the bench beneath her. With so many still waiting on her pleasure, she did not stop to eat. Instead, she dispatched Jiqui to the kitchens for a platter of flatbread, olives, figs, and cheese. She nibbled while she listened, and sipped from a cup of watered wine. The figs were fine, the olives even finer, but the wine left a tart, metallic aftertaste in her mouth. The small, pale yellow grapes, native to these regions, produced a notably inferior vintage.
"We shall have no trade in wine."
Besides, the great masters had burned the best arbors, along with the olive trees. In the afternoon, a sculptor came, proposing to replace the head of the great bronze harpy in the Plaza of Purification with one cast in Danny's image. She denied him with as much courtesy as she could muster. A pike of unprecedented size had been caught in the Skarhazardan, and the fisherman wished to give it to the queen. She admired the fish extravagantly, rewarded the fisherman with a purse of silver, and sent the pike to her kitchens. A coppersmith had fashioned her a suit of burnished rings to wear to war. She accepted it with fulsome thanks. It was lovely to behold, and all that burnished copper would flash prettily in the sun, though if actual battle threatened, she would sooner be clad in steel. Even a young girl who knew nothing of the ways of war knew that. The slippers the butcher king had sent her had grown too uncomfortable. Danny kicked them off and sat with one foot tucked beneath her and the other swinging back and forth. It was not a very regal pose, but she was tired of being regal. The crown had given her a headache, and her buttocks had gone to sleep.
"Sir Barristan," she called, "I know what quality a king needs most."
"Courage, or your grace?"
"Cheeks like iron," she teased. "All I do is sit."
"Your grace takes too much on herself. You should allow your counsellors to shoulder more of your burdens."
"I have too many counsellors and too few cushions."
Danny turned to Resnick.
"How many more?"
23, if it please your magnificence, with as many claims."
The seneschal consulted some papers.
"One calf and 3 goats. The rest will be sheep or lambs, no doubt."
"At 23, Danny sighed, "my dragons have developed a prodigious taste for mutton since we began to pay the shepherds for their kills. Have these claims been proven?"
"Some men have brought burnt bones."
"Men make fires. Men cook mutton. Burnt bones prove nothing. Bran Ben says there are red wolves in the hills outside the city, and jackals and wild dogs. Must we pay a good silver for every lamb that goes astray between Yunkai and the Skarhazardan?"
No, magnificence," Resnick bowed. "Shall I send these rascals away, or will you want them scourged?"
Daenerys shifted on the bench.
"No man should ever fear to come to me."
Some claims were false, she did not doubt, but more were genuine.
Her dragons had grown too large to be content with rats and cats and dogs. "The more they eat, the larger they will grow," Sir Barristan had warned her. "And the larger they grow, the more they'll eat." Drogon especially ranged far afield, and could easily devour a sheep a day. "Pay them for the value of their animals," she told Resnick, "but henceforth claimants must present themselves at the Temple of the Graces and swear a holy oath before the gods of Gis." "It shall be done," Resnick turned to the petitioners. "Her Magnificence the Queen has consented to compensate each of you for the animals you have lost," he told them in the Gascari tongue. "Present yourselves to my factors on the morrow, and you shall be paid in coin or kind, as you prefer." The pronouncement was received in sullen silence.
"You would think they might be happier," Danny thought. "They have what they came for. Is there no way to please these people?"
One man lingered behind as the rest were filing out. A squat man with a wind-burned face, shabbily dressed. His hair was a cap of coarse red-black wire cropped about his ears, and in one hand he held a sad-cloth sack. He stood with his head down, gazing at the marble floor as if he had quite forgotten where he was.
"And what does this one want?" Danny wondered.
"All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons," cried Missandei in her high, sweet voice.
As Danny stood, her tokar began to slip. She caught it and tugged it back in place.
"You with the sack," she called. "Did you wish to speak with us? You may approach."
When he raised his head, his eyes were red and raw as open sores. Danny glimpsed Sir Barristan sliding closer, a white shadow at her side. The man approached in a stumbling shuffle, one step, then another, clutching his sack.
"Is he drunk or ill?" she wondered.
There was dirt beneath his cracked yellow fingernails.
"What is it?" Danny asked. "Do you have some grievance to lay before us, some petition? What would you have of us?"
His tongue flicked nervously over chapped, cracked lips.
I brought bones," she said impatiently. "Burnt bones."
He lifted the sack and spilled its contents on the marble. Bones they were, broken bones and blackened. The longer ones had been cracked open for their marrow.
"It were the black one," the man said in a Gascari growl. "The winged shadow. He come down from the sky and...
"No," Danny shivered. "No, no, oh no."
"Are you deaf, fool?"
Resnick Mo Resnick demanded of the man.
"Did you not hear my pronouncement? See my factors on the morrow, and you shall be paid for your sheep."
"Resnick," Sir Barristan said quietly,
"hold your tongue and open your eyes. Those are no sheep bones."
"No," Danny thought.
"Those are the bones of a child."
Sansa. The morning of King Joffrey's name day dawned bright and windy, with the long tail of the great comet visible through the high scuttling clouds. Sansa was watching it from her tower window when Sir Aerys Oakheart arrived to escort her down to the tawny grounds. "What do you think it means?" she asked him.
"Glory to your betrothed," Sir Aerys answered at once. "See how it flames across the sky today on his grace's name day, as if the gods themselves had raised a banner in his honour. The small folk have named it King Joffrey's Comet."
Doubtless that was what they told Joffrey. Sansa was not so sure. "I've heard servants calling it the Dragon's Tail.
King Joffrey sits where Aegon the Dragon once sat, in the castle built by his son. Sir Aerys said. He is the dragon's heir, and crimson is the colour of House Lannister, another sign. This comet is sent to herald Joffrey's ascent to his throne, I have no doubt. It means that he will triumph over his enemies. Is it true, she wondered? Would the guards be so cruel? Her mother was one of Joffrey's enemies now. Her brother Rob, another. Her father had died by the king's command. Must Rob and her lady mother die next? The comet was red. But Joffrey was Baratheon as much as Lannister, and their sigil was a black stag on a golden field. Shouldn't the guards have sent Joff a golden comet? Sansa closed the shutters and turned sharply away from the window. "You look very lovely today, my lady," Sir Aerys said. "Thank you, sir." Knowing that Joffrey would require her to attend the tourney in his honour, Sansa had taken special care with her face and clothes. She wore a gown of pale purple silk and a moonstone hairnet that had been a gift from Joffrey. The gown had long sleeves to hide the bruises on her arms. Those were Joffrey's gifts as well. When they told him that Rob had been proclaimed king in the north, his rage had been a fearsome thing, and he had sent Sir Boris to beat her. "Shall we go?" Sir Aerys offered his arm, and she let him lead her from her chamber. If she must have one of the king's guard dogging her steps, Sansa preferred that it be him. Sir Boris was short-tempered, Sir Meryn cold, and Sir Mandon's strange dead eyes made her uneasy, while Sir Preston treated her like a lackwit child. Aerys Oakheart was courteous and would talk to her cordially. Once he even objected when Joffrey commanded him to hit her. He did hit her in the end, but not hard, as Sir Meryn or Sir Boris might have, and at least he had argued. The others obeyed without question, except for the Hound. But Joff never asked the Hound to punish her. He used the other five for that. Sir Aerys had light brown hair and a face that was not unpleasant to look upon. Today he made quite the dashing figure, with his white silk cloak fastened at the shoulder by a golden leaf, and a spreading oak tree worked upon the breast of his tunic in shining gold thread. "Who do you think will win the day's honours?" Sansa asked, as they descended the steps arm in arm. "I will," Sir Aerys answered, smiling. "Yet I fear the triumph will have no savour. This will be a small field, and poor. No more than 20 will enter the lists, including squires and free riders. There is small honour in unhorsing green boys." The last tourney had been different, Sansa reflected. King Robert had staged it in her father's honour. High lords and fabled champions had come from all over the realm to compete, and the whole city had turned out to watch. She remembered the splendour of it, the field of pavilions along the river with a knight's shield hung before each door, the long rows of silken pennants waving in the wind, the gleam of sunlight on bright steel and gilded spurs. The days had rung to the sound of trumpets and pounding hooves, and the night had been full of feasts and song. Those had been the most magical days of her life, but they seemed a memory from another age now. Robert Baratheon was dead, and her father as well, beheaded for a traitor on the steps of the great sept of Baelor. Now there were three kings in the land, and war raged beyond the Trident while the city filled with desperate men. Small wonder that they had to hold Joff's tournament behind the thick stone walls of the Red Keep. "Will the Queen attend, do you think?" Sansa always felt safer when Cersei was there to restrain her son. "I fear not, my lady. The council is meeting. Some urgent business." Sir Aerys dropped his voice. "Lord Tywin has gone to ground at Harrenhal instead of bringing his army to the city, as the Queen commanded. Her Grace is furious." He fell silent as a column of Lannister guardsmen marched past, in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms. Sir Aerys was fond of gossip, but only when he was certain that no one was listening. The carpenters had erected a gallery and lists in the outer bailey. It was a poor thing indeed, and the meagre throng that had gathered to watch filled but half the seats. Most of the spectators were guardsmen in the gold cloaks of the city watch, or the crimson of House Lannister, of lords and ladies, their